This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 533,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally. That's more than 129,000 in the United States alone. The number of global infections jumped to more than 11.4 million. The U.S. number surged to nearly 2.9 million. Local officials across the southern tier of U.S. states voiced new concerns Sunday about the sharp increase in the spread of the coronavirus pandemic in recent days, even as U.S. President Trump dismissed it as totally harmless. Mayor Kate Callego in the western city of Phoenix, Arizona, told ABC News' This Week show that we opened local businesses way too early after they were initially closed in March and April. The U.S. has recorded more than 50,000 new coronavirus cases on several recent days, largely across a row of southern states that avoided a big outbreak of cases in March and April when cities in the northeastern part of the country, especially New York City, were especially hard hit and now have way fewer cases. Florida, the southeasternmost U.S. state alone, recorded more than 11,400 new cases Saturday, as some big cities in the U.S. held annual independent celebrations, even as dozens of smaller communities canceled theirs for fear of people spreading the virus. With a capacity of 10,000 beds, the world's largest temporary COVID-19 hospital opened in India Sunday, as the country battles with accelerating cases of the respiratory disease. The hospital was inaugurated in New Delhi on the same day the health ministry reported a record single-day spike of more than 25,000 new cases and more than 600 deaths. This is VOA News. Iran on Sunday confirmed that a damaged building at an underground nuclear site was a new centrifuge assembly center. The organization Erner News Agency reported Iranian officials had previously sought to downplay that fire, which erupted early Thursday, calling it only an incident that affected an industrial shed. However, a released photo and video of the site broadcast by Iranian state television showed a two-story brick building with scorch marks and its roof apparently destroyed. A spokesman for Iran's nuclear agency said Sunday that work had begun on the center in 2013, and it was inaugurated in 2018. In Hong Kong, online records indicate that books written by prominent Hong Kong democracy activists have started to disappear from the city's libraries. This is just days after Beijing imposed a new national security law on the financial hub, known for its status as a semi-autonomous from the Chinese mainland. Among the authors whose titles are no longer available are Joshua Wong, one of the city's most prominent young activists, and Tanya Chan, a well-known pro-democracy lawmaker. Beijing's new national security law was imposed on Tuesday, and it is the most radical shift in how the semi-autonomous city is run since it was handed back to China by Britain in 1997. China's authoritarian leaders say the powers will not stifle freedoms and will only target a very small minority. The law targets acts of subversion, secession, terrorism, and colluding with foreign forces. Chinese leaders say the new law will restore stability after a year of pro-democracy protest, but has already sent fear coursing through a city whose people are used to speaking openly about politics and government. Prosecutors have told the judge that they'd like to schedule a Friday court appearance for Jeffrey Epstein's associate on charges she helped him recruit women to sexually abuse. British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested Thursday. She's been detained without bail after agreeing to be moved to New York. In a letter to a judge Sunday, prosecutors sought a Friday bail hearing. Prosecutors say they expect the U.S. Marshals Service to transport Maxwell to New York early this week. Maxwell has been charged with conspiring to entice girls as young as 14 years old to engage in illegal sex acts with Epstein from 1994 through 1997. Epstein is said to have killed himself in a Manhattan jail last August while he awaited trial. More at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Monday, July 6th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's new president cancels today's Independence Day festivities and scaled back his inauguration ceremonies.
As somebody that campaigned on the platform of servant leadership, which includes leading by example, he felt duty-bound to cancel that event and have something smaller in order to be somebody that the country can look to as a role model.
Eswatini teachers are going to court this morning to stop their government from reopening schools today. There are more tensions in South Sudan's unity government. We'll have an insight into why Islamists are destroying cultural sites in northern Mali. And there is a disagreement in Cameroon's separatist movement over peace talks with the Cameroon government.
Detainees need freedom. They don't need peace talks. Sudanese cannot be discussing peace for 8 million Ambazonians. They should be discussing freedom for themselves.
And an appeal to Kenya's government to lift the ban on the importation of secondhand clothes. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's new president, Lazarus Chakwera, has canceled today's 56th Independence Day festivities and scaled down his inauguration ceremonies because of the spike in coronavirus cases, up to 1,613 as of yesterday, Sunday. The inauguration was originally scheduled to take place today, Monday, at the Bingu National Stadium. President Chakwera's press secretary, Sean Campodini, says Mr. Chakwera campaigned on leading by example.
Typically what we have in Malawi is two ceremonies. The swearing-in ceremony is a judicial ceremony where the members of the judiciary presiding over the ceremony, led by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, have the president-elect and his vice president be sworn in on a Bible that they will uphold the Constitution and the rule of law. We also have an inauguration ceremony, which is a military ceremony, and that is led by senior members of the military, led by the commander of the Malawi Defense Forces. And during that ceremony, the president inspects the military guard, and he's handed symbolically by the commander the sword of command in recognition of the fact that he is now the new commander-in-chief.
The president canceled Independence Day celebrations today, Monday, because of the spike in coronavirus cases, up to 1,613 as of Sunday. What did the president say about coronavirus and how the government that he's leading will deal with the increasing number of coronavirus cases?
That's right, James. The inauguration was initially planned to take place in a stadium, and instead, President Chakwera canceled the stadium event, scaled it down to a maximum of 100. President Chakwera saw it fit to take these measures, to extend that message to the rest of the country so that people can scale up their preventive measures within their homes and their places of work in order to ensure that more is being done in this moment that the infections have intensified, that we redouble our efforts as a country in order to make sure that we are doing our part to hold the virus at bay and to flatten the curve here in Malawi. President Chakwera wants to see to it that testing is scaled up and medical personnel in our hospitals are fully equipped with protective gear, and hospitals are fully stocked with testing kits as well as ventilators. And so that is a multifaceted plan that he is putting into effect. But as somebody that campaigned on the platform of servant leadership, which includes leading by example, he felt duty-bound to cancel that event and have something smaller in order to be somebody that the country can look to as a role model for how seriously to take this pandemic and the toll that it's taking on our society.
Sean Campodini is press secretary to Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The interim government of the self-proclaimed Federal Republic of Ambazonia, representing Cameroon's English-speaking regions, says it will not hold peace talks with the government of President Paul Biya outside of a properly constituted mediation. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia, also says such constituted talks must take place outside of Cameroon. This came after the group's former jail leaders, including former President Julius Ayuk Tabe, met with Cameroon government officials last week to discuss a ceasefire. A statement issued by the jailed leaders said the meeting came after the United Nations asked to end the war because of the atrocities. However, Chris Anu says prisoners cannot discuss peace for those who are free.
We at the interim government do not think that French Cameroon is holding any peace talks with detainees. Detainees need freedom. They don't need peace talks. So detainees cannot be discussing peace for 8 million Ambazonians. They should be discussing freedom for themselves.
But do you still consider Julius Ayuk Tabe as your leader?
There is no doubt Julius Ayuk Tabe is a leader, but not the leader of the Ambazonian struggle. He was once the president of the interim government. And so by virtue of the fact that he was once the president, he is a leader. There is no doubt about that. What we are trying to say is that prisoners, people who are in chains, cannot discuss freedom for those who are free.
You see, I asked the question because Tabe said in a statement that the meeting with Cameroon official was attended by 9 separatist leaders and that he remains committed to the restoration of an independent English-speaking Cameroon.
That is true. I understand 9 of them were at the meeting, but again, none of them had the mandate to discuss either a ceasefire or peace for the rest of Ambazonians. They don't have the mandate. In fact, it will surprise you to learn that some among the 9 have actually denounced this struggle. And so how do you denounce the struggle, using it to regain your freedom, and then you are the one who is called to go and sit on some table to discuss the modalities for peace?
Chris, are you concerned that the wing of the movement that you are part of might be marginalized and therefore perhaps made irrelevant now that Tabe is said to be having these meetings with the Cameroon government?
Marginalized by who? People listening to me know that when you go to Ambazonia, where we call Ground Zero, the overwhelming population of Ambazonia support what we are doing. That is why when we call for lockdowns last week, the whole territory was shut down. No. We're not afraid of any marginalization. Nobody is going to marginalize us because Ambazonians are not stupid. Ambazonians are not fools. We are essentially saying, James, we want the Swiss dialogue initiative to take off so that at the preliminary talks, issues of ceasefire and peace and whatever can be put on the table. We start from there.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. The Association of Secondhand Clothes and Shoe Sellers in Kenya has asked the government to lift the ban on the importation of secondhand clothes, saying the suspension has contributed to massive job losses. The association, well known to many Kenyans as the Mitumba Association of Kenya, is calling on President Uhuru Kenyatta to consider them during his State of the Nation address today, Monday, where the president is expected to talk about the reopening of the economy. As Marie Ojiya reports from Nairobi, some observers don't think that President Kenyatta will reopen the economy given the rising number of COVID-19 cases.
Kenya will only lift the ban on imports of secondhand clothes once the COVID-19 pandemic is contained in the country. This is according to the Cabinet Secretary, Industry, Trade and Cooperatives, Betty Maina, who said that secondhand clothes known in Kenya's Mitumba imports from countries facing COVID-19 pandemic are restricted. Mitumba Association of Kenya Chairperson Teresia Njenga has dismissed government allegations that importation of clothes from coronavirus hard-hit countries will bring more infection elections in the country.
The importation of second-hand garments and shoes into Kenya poses no credible public health risk. The goods are shipped for 45 days on average in sealed containers. The scientific research concludes that the COVID-19 virus cannot survive on an inanimate object for longer than 9 days. In the period since March, the World Health Organization has not recommended the prohibition of movement of goods or commodities as a measure to contain the spread of COVID-19.
Kenya imports the second-hand clothes from the US, China, and Europe, which are the most hit countries with the virus. Mrs. Njenga said that there is massive job loss as most of the people working in the sector are out of work since the government suspended the importation 3 months ago.
We represent a vital business sector that has significant economic impact, and particularly in the informal jua kali sector. According to the estimates from published surveys by Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, the mitumba sector employs about 10% of the extended labor force, which translates to approximately 2 million people, both directly and indirectly as a source of livelihood.
Kenya has always contemplated on banning of second-hand clothes in the country as a way of boosting local textile farms. Another second-hand trader said that the cargo coming in the country cannot speed up the spread of COVID-19 compared to new clothes cargoes, of which most of them come into the country within 48 hours.
So most of these goods arrive in this country more healthy and of better health conditions than even the new products we purchase from in those countries. If I was to bring shirts, for example, just to give an example, if I was to bring a new shirt from China or from Turkey, these products are being handled by human beings. So it's a physical handling.
Second-hand clothes are common among Kenya's low-income earners who find them very affordable. Those whose businesses have been affected are looking forward to President Uhuru Kenyatta's State of the Nation address today, Monday, that might see some restrictions lifted. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, July 6th. Teachers in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, will file a petition this morning asking the courts to stop the government from forcing them to reopen schools today, Monday. Mbongwa Dlamini, president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, says the teachers cannot be forced to return to a hazardous work environment according to the country's Occupational and Health and Safety Act. Eswatini schools have been in partial coronavirus lockdown since mid-March this year. The country has confirmed over 900 COVID-19 cases and 13 deaths. The government says it will provide face masks for students, hand sanitizers, soaps, and water tanks to the schools. Dlamini says the teachers are willing to return to school to do their professional duty, but he says they want to do so in a safe, healthy environment.
Teachers are not ready to attend schools because the situation is too risky for them.
You said that the government did not prepare the schools to reopen, but the government said it has made available protective equipment such as face masks, hand sanitizers, soap, water, and other. What type of protective equipment do you want?
My brother, we have been making our own assessment in schools. We have discovered that in all the schools that we have assessed, there is not enough preparations. So we have a checklist with us, which we prepared with the Ministry of Health and also the Ministry of Education. And the checklist was used to see whether the schools are ready or not. We discovered that schools are not ready. Government did provide face masks, but those face masks that have been given are only given to learners, not to the teachers. Learners are given one mask per learner, which are not sufficient for the work that they are supposed to do. Otherwise, you cannot have one face mask for the whole day. So students should be given at least 3 face masks per student so that they can maybe use a face mask. After some time, they decide to change it because it is not hygienic to use one face mask for the whole day.
When we spoke the last time, did you say that the government had threatened teachers with dismissal and with no pay if the teachers did not return to school?
It is true, my brother, that the government has threatened teachers with dismissal if they don't go to work. Our understanding is that teachers are not refusing to go to work. Otherwise, they cannot be dismissed because we have got a law that suggests that if a teacher or if a worker is in a workplace and he discovered that the workplace is maybe exposing her or him to danger, he must remove himself from the danger so that he can be at a safer place and then inform the employer. In that way, the employer has to ensure safety before that employer can resume work. So in that spirit, the teachers have not absconded from work, but they decided to remove themselves from the danger as per the stipulation of the Occupational Health and Safety Act of 1980, that is Section 18 of the said act.
Mbangwa Dlamini is president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. South Sudan's peace process continues to move at a snail's pace and from time to time running into stumbling block after stumbling block. It appears the latest flashpoint centers around the nomination of General Johnson Olani as governor of Upper Nile State. Once a member of President Salva Kiir's army, Olani defected to First Vice President Riek Machar's SPLMIO in 2015. Machar nominated him as governor of Upper Nile State, but South Sudan presidential spokesperson Atain Wek Atain says President Kiir cannot appoint General Olani because Olani is a warmonger and a destabilizer of peace.
General Olani cannot be appointed as governor of Upper Nile because it was a conditional that the Upper Nile is allocated to the SPLMIO in order to nominate someone who is not General Ulun. The Upper Nile state was allocated to SPLMIO after a thorough negotiations. And the condition was that they would be given Upper Nile provided General Ulun is not the candidate for the governorship.
So what do you say to those who say that by not appointing him, you are not meeting the demands of the peace process?
The peace is what the president is now actually safeguarding. Because Johnson Oloni is a warlike, he's a warmonger, and cannot be appointed as governor in order to come and make war. And, you know, the president has a responsibility to take that peace agreement. That is why he refused Johnson Oloni.
How do you say that he is a warmonger?
Yeah, he's a warmonger, because he has not yet come back to South Sudan. He's still landing in the border of Sudan, and he's not even, reporting to the SPLMIO. These were the forces that have not been controlled or as required by the agreement.
I think General Olani says that he wants to come back to Juba, but with his own forces, a 2,000 man strong force.
That one is ridiculous. It cannot, because there is nothing in the agreement that would require Olani to come to Juba with 2,000 forces. The Riek Machar came to Juba without 2,000 forces. Who is General Olani to come with the forces? We cannot negotiate the SPLMIO under Riek Machar and also under Ulun. So the condition by Ulun, the condition set in order to attack peace is not to implement the peace agreement.
Tell me, it seems to me there's this continuing tension between the first vice president or the SPLMIO and the government. Why?
There's no tension. The SPLMIO under the leadership of Dr. Riek and the SPLMIG under the leadership of President Salva Kiir, they are cooperating and they are working together. They have a very good working relation. I cannot call attention. The president rejected Johnson Ulun on the basis of what I just told you. Because Johnson Ulun wanted to come with the forces that were not part of the revitalized agreement.
So you're saying that there's no meeting schedule between the president and Riek Machar?
No, there's no meeting schedule, but anytime Dr. Riek Machar wanted to meet the president, it's not a big story. They can meet anytime because he is the first vice president, and anytime he wants to meet the president, he can do so, and president can allow him to meet him.
Atain Wek Atain is a spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. The reasons why Islamists destroy cultural and historic sites in northern Mali, especially in Timbuktu, can provide insight into the extremist groups, says Omar Ba, an assistant professor of political science at Morehouse College. Ba, who recently published a report on these acts of destruction and Islamist explanations about the destructions, tells Ricky Schreier the reasons are too often overlooked.
Oftentimes when they destroy these sites, the rest of the world, and by that I mean Western government, but also international institutions such as UNESCO, they paint these actions as just brute violence without any religious or political motives behind it. They tend to portray these as just a barbarous act. But then again, if you look closely at what the Islamists themselves say, it's a whole different reason that they put out there. They do say that they're doing this for religious and political reasons. Now, this article itself, in the case of Tombuctu, looks at the political reasons that this is not just a random violence. It is not just destroying these sites so to upset the Western world or to shock the international community. It is embedded into political acts that are meant to govern the region and the people who live there. That's the argument of the paper.
You specifically talk about the trial of Al-Mahdi, who destroyed monuments in Timbuktu. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you learned from examining and reading those court transcripts?
Yes, Al-Mahdi was the first Islamist to be captured and taken to The Hague, and he stood trial for his role in planning and executing as a leader the destruction of these sites in Tombuctu. Al-Mahdi never denied having directed those attacks, but during the trial, through his lawyer, he provided a lot of justification for the reasons of destruction of these sites. Also, after his trial, while he was in prison, he gave an interview to a publication by UNESCO, so where he talked a lot about how they decided to destroy these monuments and what was the rationale behind it.
That was Umar Ba, assistant professor of political science at Morehouse College. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the United States. Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Egypt, where the Egyptian Football Association announced on Sunday that all Egyptian league players took PCR tests, a test that can detect antibodies from exposure to the COVID-19 pandemic, and are ready to resume sports activities. EFA said it had been given the green light by the government to resume the Premier League, which has been on hold since mid-March as part of measures to curb the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. EFA Executive Director Walid El Attar, after the test, said results of 15 players returned positive for antibodies tests, which means they sustained the virus and recovered from it. The EFA's medical committee announced late on Saturday that from among all the tests conducted, 27 persons tested positive for coronavirus, and they are now in isolation according to the protocol. The Egyptian Premier League will resume on the 7th of August, EFA announced on Thursday, after almost 5 months of suspended activities. And now to East Africa, where the Ugandan national football team head coach Jonathan McKinstry says the confirmation by the Confederation of African Football that the 2021 AFCON and the 2020 CHAN have both been postponed has come as a relief to his players. He says players will be ready to play both the 2020 African Nations Championship CHAN and the 2021 African Cup of Nations AFCON in the new dates released by CAF.
The confirmation of the CHAN tournament for January is a big motivator for all of the players. I think staff and players were all a little bit concerned that the tournament might be cancelled altogether, because in the original schedule, it was just difficult to see where it could fit in the schedule as it was. But now with the changes and it being confirmed for January, everyone now is refocused. They're energised. I know the players are hungry. The UPL doesn't start until October. But yeah, we're looking forward to it.
The two competitions were affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. 33rd edition of the biennial tournament was due to begin in Cameroon on the 9th of January 2021, but has now been postponed to January 2022. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive week.